Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant and Captain Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, where you can download our podcast on iTunes. Good morning, Francis.
Hi there, Marky.
How are you?
I'm pretty well, thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would like to entitle the first segment of our show today, A Day in the Life of a Restaurateur.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to talk about the finer things. Sorry.
All our customers had a fine time yesterday in both restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. But it was an interesting day, to say the very least. We got there a little bit early, and you will notice...
It was a tough day.
...that I am wearing the same clothes as I was wearing yesterday. And this began, you know, this is a very typical restaurant day. We began yesterday because we have, you know, we built this new restaurant, Catherine Lombardi,
mm-hmm.
right? And the hot water heater was put in such a place with the fresh air intake.
Because it needs fresh air.
It allows too much cold air in.
Mm-hmm. Fresh air sometimes in this type of weather is cold.
So I walked in yesterday to find Mark soaking wet with his suit on. His shirt off, yeah.
Right, in my T-shirt with my... dress shirt hanging over the convection oven.
Drying. Because the hot water heater had burst, and as soon as you plug up one little hole, another one came out, and water was...
Oh, it was unbelievable. So the pipe actually burst, and it was spraying water.
Yeah.
So me being the brilliant man that I am, said, there's a shutoff valve in the room. I just got to get in there. I'll get a little wet. I'll get to the shutoff valve. It'll be beautiful. Unless the shutoff valve comes off in your hand.
Oh.
And then it just keeps shooting water at you.
But the amusing thing was, we started the day that way, and then I got seeing Mark, who's a large man, a large Italian man, walking around the restaurant in a suit jacket and a T-shirt, looking very much the part.
I had my Miami Vice look working yesterday.
They were better looking in that show. And the day ended last night with me prepping for this show and putting stuff together for our shows today at, I don't know, 2 o'clock in the morning,
mm-hmm.
when I noticed after everyone had left... It just got a little chilly in the office.
Maybe somebody turned the heat down, Francis.
And I realized that the furnace was out at 2 o'clock in the morning. The day in the life of a restaurateur, so I stayed locally and met the plumbers. Yes.
Didn't somebody say to us just like a week ago, boy, you guys really lead glamorous lives,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, okay.
Plumbing. Too much plumbing.
Okay, chef said, you know what the chef said to me?
What?
He said, yeah, I'd go in there and turn it off, but I don't have another chef coat I can wear today.
All right.
Thanks, chef.
Now, I got another interesting thing. I got a resume in the mail
mm-hmm.
from a guy who used to work for us
mm-hmm.
named Keith. And the resume was very interesting because I've been waiting for years to get this resume back. This was a guy who, when he had left, and one of the interesting things about working in a restaurant is you get a volatile mix of people, and some of the
yep.
most interesting and exciting people in the world work in restaurants because you get a mix of volatile people and people who work at night. And I love restaurant people, always have.
They are a very interesting cross section of the culture.
Yeah, restaurant people are really, really interesting. Now, but Keith. I don't love. He worked for us many years ago.
About 6 months, I would say he worked for us as a line cook.
In top scumbag moves of all time.
Wow.
This story lives in legend.
It does live in legend.
We found him. He left us in wintertime. And mm-hmm. we found him, actually, our one of our line
sous
cooks.
Sous chef at the time.
Sous chef at the time. Found him on the day of his last day of employment. After he had left, she said, you know, you'd better look above the drop ceiling in the kitchen. Why is that, Annie? Well, because Keith was putting pounds of butter up there.
At first she said he was throwing something up there, and until I investigated, I didn't know what it was. I caught him standing on the low boy, throwing things into the drop ceiling.
So what we found when we took the drop ceiling apart was several pounds of butter
mm-hmm.
wrapped in multiple layers of plastic wrap, thrown up there in the middle of winter. Now, this is genius.
It is diabolical genius.
But if you come looking for a job for me several years later with the whole, hey, want to hire me
back? How you been?
I'm going to remember this. What that does is...
It's in the plenum, in a hot area of the ceiling.
And you wait until the summertime and it gets pretty hot, and that butter will leach out. Now, how butter affects a ceiling tile differently than water is it will fill a hole. It will wick out through the entire ceiling tile, mm-hmm. and you won't really notice anything other than a little stain until it entirely collapses in the food and shuts it down on a Saturday night. I was really glad to get that resume. Keith, if you're listening, we won't be calling you back.
Sometimes what comes around goes around. And that's something about the restaurant community that I think some people don't realize, too. It is a relatively small community. We do get phone calls on our employees all the time from friends who say, hey,
what about
this
guy?
I got this resume. What do you think?
And I say, you mean Butterman?
No, you say things like, I would not rehire.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what you say.
I also say, you mean Butterman? anyway, so today the New Jersey State Legislature is considering a smoking ban in New Jersey mm-hmm. that would be equal to put us on even putting with footing with New York.
I don't want to be on even putting with New York.
No, neither do I. Now, the interesting thing about this smoking ban is the casinos are trying to exempt themselves. There'd be a ban in all public places except for casinos.
Yeah, this is going to pass, too.
I think it's got a likelihood of passing, but it's just wrong.
It's wrong.
And the main reason it's wrong is if you exempt casinos.
It's wrong because it's unjust is the main reason it's wrong.
You know, and
smoking is really, really, really bad for you unless you're gambling at the same time.
Right.
Then it's not so bad.
The argument offered by the casino companies and the politicians that they own is, well, we can't possibly ban smoking in casinos because that will hurt them when you consider they compete with Las Vegas and other gaming areas. However, that their bars and restaurants will compete with the other bars and restaurants that are mm-hmm. casinos in New Jersey. When you bring up that argument, they say, oh, the smoking ban doesn't hurt business at all. In fact, it's good for business. Well, if it's good for business, why are the casinos against it? I guess the casinos must be stupid and not know what hurts their business.
Yeah, those guys don't know anything. Come on.
Well, you know, go ahead.
You know, the whole smoking ban, okay, Francis and I have talked about this over from time to time. Non-smoker. Francis is pretty much a non-smoker. He smokes the occasional cigar. You're talking to two non-smokers here who just believe that either make this illegal, make this an illegal habit, or stop trying to regulate businesses from the way they run their business.
And here's where it comes down to. Listen, you've listened to this show. You know that Mark and I are all about customer service. We're all about being welcoming mm-hmm. in a place of community. But a business is not a train station built by tax dollars. You don't have a right to go to a business. If they play loud rock and roll that if you listen to it every night will hurt your ears, go to a different restaurant if you don't like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if they allow smoking, as long as it's posted, I think that the private sector business should be allowed to offer smoking to clients who want to smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't like it, don't go there. There is no right of you to come into my restaurant.
Right.
Now, look, we offer entirely separate ventilated mm-hmm. rooms. You
right.
Know?
We have one. Frankly, we've gotten to the point where, yes, non-smoking seems to be the way of the world and the way most diners want to go. So we've said this very small area of our dining room is allowed to have smoking, and it's separately ventilated.
It has its own furnace.
And it has its own furnace, exactly. And so we've acquiesced to that, but we shouldn't be forced to do that by the government. We should be forced to do that because you say so.
When we come back from the break, we're going to be talking to our friend Chris Goodhart, who's one of the top wine buyers in New York City, and we're going to be talking to him about this subject and so many more. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal and Francis Schott of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we have joining us a special guest, Chris Goodhart, in addition to being a friend of ours, is one of the top wine directors in New York City. He buys wine for Keith McNally's restaurants, Balthazar, Pastis, Lucky Strike, and Schiller's Liquor Bar, among them. For those of you not conversant with really cool New York City restaurants, these are all on the short list. They're also very different from each other and very much in the limelight. He's often been a panelist for the New York Times. In short, he's one of the most influential tastemakers in New York City. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi. Wow. Influential tastemakers. I like that. Thank you very much.
Can I blurb Chris, your book?
Hey, Chris. How are you?
I'm good. By the way, congratulations to you guys on Catherine Lombardi Restaurant.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, man.
You must be thrilled.
We are indeed.
We are, and you have to come down and eat with us.
Absolutely.
Now, you work for a whole bunch of different restaurants in Manhattan, and I want to talk about those, because I think you have a pretty interesting set of different wine programs that go on there. But before that, you were sommelier and beverage manager at Windows in the World, at the top of the World Trade Center. What was that like?
Well, very different from, well, it was way up high. That's the big difference. Now I'm in the basement. I'm freezing to death. But, yeah, it was a great experience. I started my wine career in the cellars with I call him iconic because it's true, Kevin Zraley.
Oh, yeah. And,
I was a cellar rat. I mean, I sort of equate it to being a wine librarian, just receiving tons and tons of wine. A lot of people don't realize that Windows in the World was two floors, 106 and 107, and we had 2 acres of floor space, with about three quarters of that being banquet space.
2 acres. Did you grow corn?
Well, yeah, we grew corn and soybeans. It was all sustainable, believe it or not. Alice Waters was very proud of us.
It was also the highest wine cellar in the world on the 106th floor of the World Trade Center, and it was, at the time, the largest grossing independent wine program in the world of any restaurant. Isn't
that
true?
That's right. Yeah, it was. I mean, we were very proud of that, but we were, I think, more proud of what we hope was an interesting wine program. Mm-hmm. And it spanned the entire globe. Kevin Zraley was one of the first people in the 70s when Windows opened to really focus on California wines, which a lot of people forget. I mean, it wasn't sort of sexy to have Opus 1, or even people knew about it, or even Old Mondavi wines or whatever, but Kevin was one of the first people to do that. So, it was a great program. It was also sad to see it go.
You know, that was one of the saddest things in the world. It's funny, being in the restaurant business, there was so much tragedy around September 11th, of course.
Sure.
But, you know, restaurant employees, you know, they were working breakfast up there, you know, and
yeah.
and there were a number of funds. We did a little benefit. A lot of restaurant people around the world came together to do benefit for the families of the people who were lost there. But
yep.
Kevin Zraley, who you mentioned, he's written a book which is, to my mind, the best wine primer ever written in the English language, which is the Windows in the World Wine Course book.
I mean, I agree with you. Yeah, absolutely.
We literally give that book to every single new employee who starts for us. And you were talking earlier about that wine steward or wine rat position.
Sure.
You know, anybody who's really interested in this business, that's a great way to start out in a restaurant wine program.
Sure.
Because you just get exposed to every single bottle of wine that comes into a great restaurant wine list.
I think you're right. I mean, I've really taken sort of, I hope I've taken Kevin's cue, and at the Keith McNally restaurants, we do have a wine internship program.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the interns, they're unpaid as well, which a lot of people don't realize. And a lot of the interns are students at the French Culinary Institute who, after taking wine classes there, realize, maybe I'm more interested in wine than being in the kitchen. And then we also have, I mean, even now we have a guy that works at Bear Stearns making a lot of money, and he's thinking of making that jump from being in the making a lot of money.
I hope you're trying to convince him not to.
It's funny because I really warn, I mean, when I'm interviewing or just talking to potential candidates for the cellar rat program here, I warn them that it's a lot of heavy work. But at the same time, like you mentioned, just being around the bottles, and I mean, just the amount of information I think that one absorbs just looking at the label,
mm-hmm.
It's sort of the subconscious, now I know how to spell Chambon Moussigny without even thinking about it.
Yep.
So, it's invaluable, and I actually do recommend Kevin's book, The Windows in the World Wine School book, as a book to anybody starting. So.
We teach a class on wine. Actually, we're starting up again in January, and I've taught that class for 15 years, and I shamelessly stole the class format from Kevin.
Good.
And I use the book as a basis. If you're looking for it on the web, it's called The Windows in the World Wine Course book. It makes a great a gift to any wine person.
Definitely.
Now, Chris, you have in the various restaurants that you work for, you have a lot of interesting and a lot of different lists, but you have a really laid-back approach to wine. You have wine-knowledgeable people on the floor of every restaurant,
yep.
And they're really cool and laid-back about that. How do you get there?
It's good to hear that. I mean, I think a lot of it starts from, you know, really, even before I was here, I've been in this job for a few years now, and Keith McNally, the owner, he's a British guy, and I say guy because people hear British and they think gentleman. I mean, he's a gentleman, but you know, he's not a gentleman.
We won't tell him that he you just said he's not a gentleman.
Right. Well,
right? We won't share that.
He is, but he's not, you know, a gentleman. But he has a laid back. It's a weird balance. I mean, he has a laid back approach to. He just wants to make people comfortable,
mm-hmm.
and I think that you can't do that with being formal, and you can't do that with being intimidating, and that's something you hear a lot, I think, in the past 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Balthazar, for example, is our highest volume restaurant, and it's our most ambitious wine program with over 400 wines, but you know, we don't want it to be too precious, and, you know, we don't want to have a vertical of Chateau Petrus, and I think that philosophy, I hope, extends to everybody on the floor who's talking about wine, whether it's a waiter or...
How do you get them, how do you communicate that to your staff, that people are sort of laid back and cool about stuff?
Well, I think, cool is a dangerous word to me, too, because I mean, it's nice to hear that. I hope you associate that impression with, oh, we're just kind of nice and laid. But,
yeah, exactly.
But I think part of it is we do a lot of wine training. An unusual part of my job is that while I was on the floor at Windows in the World as a sommelier, Keith didn't want a formal sommelier on the floor because, for example, Balthazar and Pastis, I mean, were based on bistros, brasseries, and you really wouldn't have a sommelier in France, you know, sort of wandering the floor with a suit. So I really have to train the staff a lot, and I really consider them, or at least a lot of them who have been here for a while, you know, many sommeliers, if not maybe even hopefully better than I am when I was
on the floor. One of the things that we're trying to train our people on the floor is to make it less intimidating, and that was a word that you used.
We'll be back in just a moment talking with Chris Goodhart. He's one of the top sommeliers in New York City, and we're going to be talking about wine and also restaurants in general in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
You're back with The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Today we're talking to Chris Goodhart, one of the most famous wine buyers in all of New York City.
Hey, Chris, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
You know, you buy for a number of different kinds of restaurants. You buy, you know, Balthazar, Pastis, Lucky Strike. How do you decide what wines go where? How do you give individual places their own personality?
And the places are so different, and the wine lists need to be so different. How are you choosing?
The main focus, Balthazar and Pastis, it's sort of easy because we only list French wines.
Mm-hmm.
I generally like to keep a price point. You know, Balthazar, we have about 400 wines, and I'd like there to be a lot of wines that are, you know, in the $30 to $40 range. Pastis is a smaller list, but again, it's all French. But then when Schiller's, for example, which is our newest restaurant in the Lower East Side, it's a pretty small list, and I call that my selfish list because I put little weird things on there that nobody's heard of, and I really have to get the waiters to know them and sell them. But
things that you would really want to drink.
Exactly, things that I'd really want to drink. And we also have our Wines by the Glass at Schiller's listed. This was Keith McNally's idea as good... cheap, decent, and good. So I can, for example, now we have a Tarantis by the glass, and nobody would order Tarantis, but now they can just say, oh, I'll have a glass of the, you know, I'll have a good glass, or I'll have a good carafe. So they don't have to say it. We had Gruner Veltliner there before, and we've had some other weird things, and so, we're doing volume on them, which is exciting. So yeah, it's really, and Lucky Strike and Unprobed are more sort of, mm-hmm. bar places, so the wine programs are really, really abbreviated. But it's fun for me just to sort of put my mind, you know, with each place and what it should be. But it's
nice having the different avenues in which to kind of show the your wares.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm excited because as much as I buy French wine, we're actually opening a restaurant next year in the West Village, an Italian restaurant. So. You're our competition.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell people not to go over
the bridges and the tunnels.
We have been having a lot. I have to say, expanding the Italian wine list with having this Italian, this Brooklyn Italian kind of feel restaurant has been a lot of fun. It's really, really been a good experience.
Well, one of the things that we've always found very interesting in New Jersey, and I have a lot of respect for what you do out there in a real laid-back environment, is the easy way out is to pick the well-known names, mm-hmm. is to pick the things that people are going to know. if you pick things that are a little more esoteric and a little unusual, but that are really great, then, you know, it's a little more work getting over that hump. But then when people come to find something, if you like Ribolla Gialla in New Jersey, you know, the number of restaurants you can go to and find it again.
There are two of us.
Yeah, exactly, you know.
I'm really glad that you recognize that in the wine program. That's one of the most important things to me, particularly, again, using Balthazar as an example. You're right, it is. There are a lot of larger producers, you know, some of them referred to as negociantes, you know, that everybody's heard of, and a lot of them are doing really good jobs, like Jadot and Latour, and Favelifer is just three examples in Burgundy, but and I've tried a lot of their wines and I like them, but I feel that they are widely available, and we want guests to come to Balthazar.
Well, and also, if you have a place with a serious wine program and they're getting tipped on it and they're charging a little more for it, it's incumbent upon a restaurant to do a little work and to bring you something a little unusual. We're talking with Chris Goodhart. He is one of the top wine buyers in New York City. We're going to be talking with him more about restaurants in New York City and American wine programs in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com. Now you can download our podcasts on iTunes for free.
And in the spirit of shameless plugs, we've announced our January wine calendar, where we have an amazing series of wine dinners coming up with a couple of restaurateurs from Boulder, Utah. Paul Hobbs is going to come out, one of the most famous winemakers on three continents, to do a wine dinner. We also have the wine course. So if you're interested in the things we're talking about today and would like to know more about them, we have a 6-week wine course we offer.
We only teach it once a year.
We have gift certificates available for that. You can reach us at our website at restaurantguysradio.com, or you can call us at the restaurant at 732-828-4444. Today our guest is Chris Goodhart, in addition to being a friend and really nice guy. He is a top wine buyer in New York City. He runs a number of wine programs at Keith McNally's restaurants, Balthazar, Pastis, Lucky Strike, Schiller's Liquor Bar. He's been a panelist on the New York Times in their wine panel on Wednesdays. And in short, he is a pretty influential tastemaker in New York City. We're talking to him about wine and restaurants. Hello again, Chris.
Hi.
Chris, talking about influential tastemakers, one of the things that happened in New York recently was the French guide, the Michelin guide, came to the United States, and the first city in the United States that they published in was New York City.
Right.
There's a lot of hubbub about that, and then it seemed to be the deafening sound of silence, kind of a poof. What's your take on Michelin coming to New York?
I guess I'm going to be kind of critical here. Well, I was an English major, so first of all, I just wasn't big on the writing for starters. But first, it's actually positive, I think, that there's interest in the New York dining scene, you know, sort of on the scale that I don't know if it scales the word, but at least the Michelin had interest in it. And
so it shows that there's a real international recognition that New York is one of the top food cities in the world.
Absolutely, and I think that's been true for a while. But the sort of having Michelin is it is an iconic thing, and I think it does serve a purpose. More probably, I think it's probably more relevant for Europeans than it is, I think, for Americans. And I think that as New Yorkers, well, first of all, we're a little bit not welcoming of just about anybody who comes in, outside of the hospitality business, I should say. So I think overall, I mean, I was definitely, and I think you've heard this echoed from other people like Mario Batali, but I was definitely sort of, quite frankly, put off that there was very little focus on Italian restaurants. There were so many were reviewed and only two got stars in New York, which is kind of unusual to me. And even I have really no connection to Chanterelle, for example, but I was really surprised that they didn't get a star. I mean, I've had meals there, and Roger Daghorn has put together one of the best wine
tours. Yeah, he's amazing.
I think Chanterelle is one of the top 10 restaurants in Manhattan. I mean, Chanterelle is a spectacular restaurant, and I think that's really the point that those of us who are kind of in the circle of New York, New Jersey restaurants felt is, and why it kind of landed with a little bit of a thud here, while we were so excited to see it, I think that there were a lot of mistakes.
Let me bring everybody up to speed. What happened was the Michelin Guide is the most influential guidebook outside of America in the world, in all of Europe. You know, 3 stars in the Michelin Guide is the highest accolade you can receive. People have killed themselves over losing stars or under the threat of losing stars in the Michelin Guide in Europe. And they've come to the United States, and they started in New York, and they published a restaurant guide of restaurants in New York. And this was much ballyhooed, and it was paid, a lot of attention was paid to this. But it's interesting because I don't think that people in the restaurant community, we have a very well-established community of restaurateurs and restaurant professionals, and we also have a very well-established journalistic community in New York. And so it feels a little like, who cares what you Europeans think of what we're doing in New York? We have our own set of standards, and yours are obviously very different.
And not just that. I think that some of us just said, or some of us who are, and I don't want to say in the know kind of restaurant
people,
have
dined around a lot.
But we know which of our peers are doing a really good job and which of our peers are doing a less good job.
Yeah, and I totally agree. And actually, one thing that hasn't really been discussed or talked about, as far as I know, or even written about, is that in within the guide, there's a symbol given that denotes if the restaurant has an interesting wine list. And I found it highly unusual that a lot of restaurants that got stars, some even that got, I believe, 2 stars, didn't get that symbol. One, I felt that some of them definitely should have had it, because they do have interesting, which is such a basically, I hope most wine programs are interesting if you've got somebody really passionate about it. And the other thing was that if you got a star, you damn well should have it.
Right. Why is a restaurant getting a star that doesn't have an interesting wine list?
Yeah. So it was kind of unusual. So I felt that on the wine, on the food, a lot of the focus has been the food side, which makes sense. But there's a lot of inconsistencies, I think, in how they designated who has an interesting wine program or not.
Yeah. And again, remember, Michelin Guide is 1, 2, or 3 stars. And 1 stars is a pretty important restaurant. It's not like some of the more local publications. Their gradations are different.
Now, let's talk about that, though. Let's talk about when you go to a restaurant, what makes a wine list? What makes a wine list interesting? What do you think, on all different levels of price range, what makes a wine list interesting?
Well, you talked a little bit about having a guest come in and see something that they've never had before, they've never seen before, or they know of a wine that is, a holy grail of Pinot Noir or Albarino or whatever it is, and it's on your list. I know, Francis, that you're a huge worshiper at the altar of Nicolas Joly.
He's a great wine producer in the Loire Valley named Nicolas Joly.
And by the way, he probably has an altar at the vineyard.
I heard about the photograph of Francis kissing the ground at the restaurant, and I don't blame him.
Oh, yeah.
Just for, again, to bring everybody up to speed, Nicolas Joly is one of those, I'm going to say, amazing but zany kind of
wine producers,
and has his own vineyard. Is unique in the world and makes some of the most special wine in the world.
And it's hard to find this wine, but when you do find it, because it's hard to sell it, so you got to bring a little to the table to understand it. But these wines age really well, and if you go to a place and you see a Nicolas Joly wine, J-O-L-Y, or a wine from the French wine region called Sauvignon, you're not going to recognize it. But the idea is, if you go to a restaurant and you see a wine list that has a bunch of wines that you don't recognize, that's often the mark of quality, because it's easy to go to the local salesman from whatever big distributor and say, okay, give me all the...
Right, I'll take Silver Oak and
Robert
Mondavi, much of it you have.
Whatever you have. And that's...
Right.
Kendall Jackson, bring it on.
That doesn't take a real professional. But to translate that, sometimes you go to a place and there's maybe some wine buyer who put together this list, but there's no one there to talk to about it.
Yeah.
How do you make sure that you always have people on your floor that can communicate with people about wines and treat it as sort of a fun thing and a bit of an adventure to bring to people, rather than have it be a stuffy thing? How do you achieve that in all
the
different
places? Well, part of it,
in
terms of, again, just using Balthazar as an example, we have at least 2 captains, meaning sort of 4 managers on the floor every night. And they're sort of trained as mini sommeliers, if not full-fledged sommeliers. Plus, all the staff, and I think they're sort of tired of seeing my face. I train so much, but actually, I take that back. I think we've actually established a great sort of wine culture at our restaurants. But part of that is just really, you know, again, you say breaking it down, not making it intimidating. I even start by, and this sounds sort of gimmicky, but it kind of works for us. But I tell all of the servers, whether you're a bartender or server, or even if you're a captain, that the first thing before you think about anything else in a wine that I want you to know are three things that you can say in one sentence. One is, what's the body style? What's the grape and or the region? And just name a dish that goes well with it. I mean, using Sancerre as an example, somebody says, what is Sancerre like? Oh, it's a lighter bodied wine made from Sauvignon Blanc. And it's really great with our Fruit de Mer.
You know, that's a very interesting point, because I think the idea is when you go to a restaurant, I think, you know, you tip on wine. Wine's more expensive in a restaurant. It has to be, because it costs more to present it in a restaurant than in a retail environment. What you have a right to expect, I think, is that they will know a little bit about their wines, and they'll know what food it goes with. So you don't, as the customer, need to know. You need to be able to place yourself in their hands and be handed a whole experience.
Yeah, and I think that, absolutely, and I think that, again, it starts with, like you said, giving basic information. I think a lot of people that aren't close to wine get intimidated because they forget that it is subjective. So if I say I smell clove and, you know, cow manure and, you know, tobacco, and somebody says, I don't get that, well, they're actually correct in not getting it because they don't get it.
Right, that's okay. You know, it's the old adage of when Mark once said, yeah, I don't like that wine, and our friend Jorge said, well, Mark, you're wrong, and he said, you mean I do like that wine?
Yeah.
Anyway, we're talking with Chris Goodhart. He's one of the most influential wine buyers in New York. We'll talk more about restaurants in America in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:45.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
You're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis from Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Chris Goodhart. He's a top wine director in New York City, and we're here talking about all things wine and what's going on in New York City right now. Chris, there's a lot of controversy right now as people move away from cork in wines, and you see a lot more quality wines coming out with screw caps on them. Where do you stand on the whole cork versus screw cap controversy?
I have to give you sort of answer that in a couple ways, but I personally, if I go into a wine shop and I see a wine that I'm interested in and it has a screw cap, I'm actually excited because I know that I can take it home and it's not going to be corked. And
corked is when a wine is in. Sometimes the reason we're moving to screw caps, just so you all know out there, to bring everybody up to speed, is sometimes in natural cork, which is a natural product, there is a substance in there that as the cork degrades can foul the wine. And the reason people are moving to screw caps is because when you have a screw cap, that's much less likely to happen.
And also, there seems to be more and more bad cork in the marketplace right now.
So I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No. I mean, in some ways, when I sort of think of, or not think of, but being on the floor presenting a bottle, I actually like there is sort of a theater, sort of a dramatic sort of notion of, you know, taking the cork out and presenting it, and, you know, it's this whole ritual, and I actually like that for some reason, even though I'm definitely, I'm not very conservative-minded in other parts of my life, but in terms of that, I am. But so on the one hand, I recognize how great it is that fewer people are going to get tainted bottles that are tainted by I won't get into the
TCA, but, right?
TCA is
the but you like the tradition.
Yeah, I like the tradition, and it's interesting because I've spoke to a couple of other sommelier friends of mine, and some of them, I mean, you probably know this. If they have a wine that screw cap on their list, when they present the bottle, they put their hand, it's like they're ashamed of it, you know, they put their hand over the screw cap, and then they, you know, hopefully can just sort of untwist it and make it not a sort of not obvious to the entire
table. They're trying to be discreet.
Exactly.
It's sort of a jarring experience to order a $100 bottle of wine and have someone come over with a screw cap.
Yeah, I mean, it's... Again, I you know, Plump Jack, of course, as you probably know, is a perfect sort of example of an expensive wine, you know, from California, of course, that's over $100, and it does come in a screw cap package, if you will. And I'm really sort of torn of, well, yes, it's great that somebody's not going to have corked wine, but at the same time, suddenly the ritual of pulling out the cork is not there. So, Keith McNally, who I think is a traditionalist in some ways, just in terms of what we do at Balthazar, he's not a fan of just simply how they look.
Yeah.
So I people just associate it with something like Zima.
Right.
Right, exactly.
But I think
not that Zima's bad. But.
Right.
Oh,
well,
yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Quit it.
Come
on, cut it out.
as more and more, I don't think Zima's ever going to be a sponsor of this show. But as more and more wineries switch to it, I think people will get more and more used to it, and it will become less of a stigma. But at the same time, I'm still a cork puller. I think that I want to pull the cork out of the bottle, and I'll taste it for you, and I'll make sure it's not corked.
There's a straight line that doesn't come along every day.
So
now, in any of your restaurants, does the staff taste the wine before they present it to the customers?
Well, with our wines by the glass, yes, all the bottles that are open, we do taste them or nose them.
What about when people order full bottles of wine?
They don't, and part of that is I think you add a level of formality, which is appropriate in some restaurants, and it doesn't necessarily have to be formal, but let me taste this for you, or taking it to the side, and part of it is even the function that we're lucky to be really, really busy, and it's hard even to
right.
find space.
Spatial constraints.
That. And so, but it makes me nervous because I think all of us in the restaurant business, and particularly the wine business, realize that most people don't really know what cork is.
Right, they just think that you've chosen a terrible bottle of wine on the list. They don't realize that something's wrong. We actually have wrestled with this ourselves because in Stage Left, which is our formal restaurant, we have formal service where the waiter will come over, open the bottle of wine, and some of you out there may not have experienced this before, but the waiter will actually taste your wine before he offers it to the host to taste it, to make sure that nothing's wrong with it.
Yeah.
Now, in Catherine Lombardi, it's a much more casual environment. We come and open the bottles table side. We don't use a side table. And it's sort of hard to do that. And what's odd is, you know, do we do it very informally like you guys are? But we might miss a few bottles and the customer gets an off bottle. They drink halfway. They drink it halfway.
That's the worst experience. Yeah. You go back to your customer's left half a bottle on the table, and you go back and taste it and say, "Oh, it's corked. They had a bad bottle."
And when
gone.
And when a wine is corked, you out there in listener land, when you have a bottle that's bad, and the way I suggest, if you're a consumer and you've gotten it, and you have an anyways decent wine knowledgeable staff, the way to handle that is to hand it back to the person who poured it to you. And a way to not be confrontational if you don't know what's going on and you don't know whether it's right or not is to say, could you taste this? Is this right? And if they have any integrity at all, there'll be someone on the staff who can taste it and say, you know, it's not. Let me get you a fresh bottle.
Yeah, I think that one thing, I think that's a great way to approach it. I've actually found or sort of bought this up in meetings with our captains who really, you know, again, they're the wine pros on the floor all the time. That I think one thing we don't talk about in the restaurant business is that some people, even great sommeliers and great wine directors, are more sensitive to corkiness than others. And sometimes there's an assumption that everybody's going to say, yes, that's a cork bottle. So I bring it up only because I'm not naming any names, but I've recognized even a couple of people that are on our staff are really sensitive to it. And I actually, when I know they're on the floor, I encourage other, if there's any doubt, you know, bring it to John Doe.
Sure.
To check it out.
Sure.
Got the nose. So it, in some ways, it's almost like if somebody walks into a room with, you know, perfume, you're going to have some people like, oh my God, that just reeks. And other people are like, what? I don't smell.
You're right, they barely smell it at all.
I mean, even in our place, Francis gets it on the nose much more than I do. I get it much more on the palate than he does. It's just our own differences.
Our guest today is Chris Goodhart. He's wine director for Keith McNally's restaurants in New York City. We'll be talking more with him in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, you're back with Mark and Francis, the restaurant guys from Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in downtown New Brunswick. We're talking with Chris Goodhart, who's the wine director for several restaurants in Manhattan. And, you know, I want to just ask you pretty quickly, the subject of smoking bans in restaurants is pretty hot right now in Jersey. Now, you've had a smoking ban in New York City. You've been in the restaurant business for a long time.
Oh.
And you're a couple of years in now. Has the smoking ban changed the way people drink?
Wow. It's interesting because I share an office with the bar manager at Balthazar, and he works up at the bar too, behind it a lot. And when I started working here a few years ago, the smoking ban hadn't been put into place, and Balthazar is one big open room, so you'd have a fifth of the restaurant is the bar, and everybody's smoking, and we're French food and French wine, so there's that sort of. Just the culture of smoking was
right.
Such a part of the restaurant, and then suddenly, after I'd been here for about 6 months, it was gone.
Right.
Literally within one day, people were smoking; one day, it wasn't. So, yes, I think that it's this odd combination of people are apt to maybe drink more because they don't have that sort of that maybe they're nervous because they don't have their nicotine.
Interesting.
But at the same time, you also sort of lose customers in a way who want to leave the bar and go outside and smoke. And so, they're out there for 10 minutes, smoking and maybe even talking for a little bit, the fellow smokers. So they're not drinking while they're out there smoking. So, I think I don't think it's affected our sales as much as it's actually affected the habits of people at the bar, whether they're drinking more while they're at the bar and then drinking less while they're out smoking.
Do you think that it's cut down? And one of the things that people say who are opposed to the ban, like me, all the time, is that it cuts down on, it would tend to cut down on, port and brandy and people lingering after a meal.
That's a really good point. Yes. I mean, I think, cigars, and we did allow cigars too when the smoking ban wasn't in effect. So I think, it makes sense that people that did enjoy, I mean, as you probably know, sommeliers in training were trained on cigar service.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, so it's really sort of a part of the culture of wine is it is inclusive of tobacco. So I would agree with you that yes, people are less likely to drink say Armagnac, Cognac, Calvados, even port for that matter, because they can't have their cigar with it or they can't sit and smoke afterwards. I mean, even going to France, when I travel to France a few times a year, I don't smoke myself. I used to, but I like the idea of sitting afterwards with somebody who smokes. I like the smell of smoke for whatever reason, and just sitting for a half an hour after a meal, just talking and maybe having a cognac, and they can smoke.
I think the interesting thing is that it does have a change in the culture. So people say it has no effect. That's not really honest. It may be beneficial, it may not be. But a lot of people out there with some misinformation. Hey, we need to run. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Chris, it was great. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
That was Chris Goodhart. He is Keith McNally's wine buyer in New York City. He buys for several restaurants and he's an influential tastemaker. And I hope you enjoyed his time with us on The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.